The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
I'm Mike Consul.
And I'm Loretta Klodfelter.
Welcome to Inside the Edition for September 2017. The headline reads, "A Welcome Development." The kicker says, "Foreign immigration supports economic growth and real estate investment success." The author is none other than Loretta Klodfelter, editor of Institutional Real Estate Americas. And immigration, Loretta, has become a hotter issue with the presidential campaign and eventual election of President Donald Trump than many people ever imagined it would be. And here you are touching that third rail. What gives?
Well, it's important. You know, this is an issue that has deep implications for real estate investment. You know, one of the things that supports economic growth and real estate in particular is a growing population. If you're going to be building property, if you're going to be leasing property, for the most part, you need to fill that property with people. And so one of the ways that we get a growing population in this country is through immigration, new people coming to this country. It's just, you know, it's just how the math works. If we didn't have any immigration, we would have a falling population. With immigration as it currently stands, we have a growing population. You know, this is just math. So, but, you know, because we are in a particular political moment, you know, immigration has become something of a question. It's you know, while the real estate industry mainstream, and I've talked to quite a few people before and after this piece, the real estate industry mainstream is very much in favor of a legal immigration, of legal immigration, and not and not restricting that legal immigration. The real estate industry has no, the mainstream of it has no interest in reducing immigration. But what we're seeing is a you know, some people in Congress, some senators, as well as a president that's quite eager to sign these bills, and an attorney general who is also a big supporter, who want to restrict legal immigration to this country, basically cut it in half. And that could have a real impact both on real estate and on the economy overall. I think there was a study from economists at Moody's Analytics that said for each 1% increase in immigration creates a 1.15% increase in GDP. You know, some of this feels very just, well, of course. So, yeah, if we saw a restriction in immigration, which, granted, while we do have quite a bit of rhetoric coming out of the administration, there actually hasn't been real deep cuts in legal immigration yet. There have been the travel ban. There's been the which restricted people, you know, people coming from seven Muslim majority nations. There have been cuts to refugees coming into the country, and just even since we published the story, there's been news surrounding DACA, which is the deferred action for childhood arrivals. These are people who came to who were brought to this country as children illegally, but are now mostly in their 20s and have used DACA to sign up and get work permits. And he's going, you know, Trump has said he's going to end the program. But, you know, he's also talking with leaders in Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, about some sort of plan to sort of extend or codify how these people are going to be able to stay in the country. So, you know, this, to a large extent, this article is a bit of a thought experiment of what could happen, as so much as, you know, as it's not just saying what will happen or what has happened.
You know, immigration has so many dimensions. It's not just Republicans versus Democrats. I think the administration is getting the most pushback right now from the business community. They need those workers, whether it's agriculture, and certainly construction uses a lot of immigration. You look at our demographics, we would be an aging country if not for young Hispanics and Asians and people from other parts of the world coming in. The other thing is that when they ask Hispanics, which obviously is a large part of the immigration we've been seeing in recent decades, what is the American dream?
A declining percentage. It's still the largest, but a smaller group as people from around the world also come. Yeah.
But one of the key things that Hispanics bring to this country is when they're asked, what's the American dream? It's to own your own home, which really propels the housing market. They not only build the homes, they buy the homes. And now Asian immigration has eclipsed Hispanic immigration. And so you're really talking about two sides to this coin, it sounds like, Loretta, because the construction industry needs people to build, and at the same time, they also need people to occupy.
Depends on the property type, and we go a little bit into the different property types and how they interact with immigration. So, for instance, something like apartments as a property type, that's one of the clearest examples, because that is people living in an apartment, and so what you need is population growth, more people coming in into a particular market. Whether they are international or domestic migrants, you just want a city to be growing. And so people coming in, people renting apartments, that's a clear connection. Retail is another one where just pure additional bodies is what you're looking for, is people, more people shopping, more people going to the mall, more people going to the grocery store. With the other property types, if you're talking about like office or industrial, it's not quite so much about population growth as it is the way that population growth keys into a broader economic growth, because that's what you really need. You want growth in jobs, growth in economic activity, and population growth has just a really direct correlation with that broader GDP activity. And so that's really where you're going to see the connection with, for instance, warehouses. It's just, better economic position, you're going to see more goods moving through warehouses, et cetera. So it varies, as I said, by property type. We looked at student housing, which could be affected by a decline in international students coming to the U.S. Perhaps they might decide that the political climate is less welcoming, and so maybe we might see fewer students from overseas coming to the U.S., which could have an impact for student housing. Because, again, with student housing, the purpose-built private student housing as well as apartments, you will see that immigrants are more likely to rent when they come to this country than they are to initially buy, and they are more likely to use this purpose-built student housing than they are they're not necessarily living at home with their parents, because they have actually come to this country to go to school. And so there's definitely going to be, that's really where you see people going. When it comes, like I said, so when it comes to other property types, it's more about broader economic growth. When it comes to housing, residential, it's really about pure population growth. One thing that's interesting is if you look at the patterns of immigration and migration throughout the United States, what you will see is that the primary first-tier gateway markets are really the ones where their population growth is being driven by immigrants, by foreign immigration. New York City would be shrinking if it weren't for new people coming in from overseas. Whereas the secondary markets tend to be driven more by domestic migration. So some of the up-and-coming cities throughout the Sun Belt are mostly being driven by Americans moving to those markets. So, somewhere like Raleigh, Charlotte, that's really where you're seeing more domestic migration pushing the population growth. But, it doesn't from a real estate investor perspective, it doesn't really matter where the people are coming from. What matters is that the city is growing.
And one of the pressure points with the administration seems to be that while they're looking to cut back even legal immigration, they want people who are educated, speak English, and actually come with a pocket full of money. The classic story is the immigrant with 25 cents in the pocket and work their way up to building a company or what have you. Now it seems that the current administration is thinking more in terms of, we want you to come in here as people of means and education and slot right into society.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. You know, if you look closely at the RAISE Act, which was submitted in the Senate by Senators Cotton and Senator Perdue, the RAISE Act would basically cut immigration in half from about a million, legal immigration, about a million people a year to about 500,000. But it would also, as you're discussing, create this points-based system to prioritize certain high-skilled immigrants. And if you want to get into the nitty-gritty of the bill, the way it's written, the points are extremely hard to get enough points to be allowed in. I went through and I looked at whether or not I would be able, and I don't have the points. And I, you know, I speak English. I hope I do, at least. And I can.
We understand you.
Listeners can judge just how fluent I am as an English speaker. But, you know, as an English speaker with an advanced college degree, I still don't have, you know, I didn't quite hit the cutoff to be allowed in. So I think that even that system could work quite a bit to restrict the flow of people even further, in that there may be very few people who actually meet the criteria that they're setting for letting people in. Now, this is not to say that a points-based system is bad. I believe Canada, Australia also use some variant of this in their immigration plans, but the distinction between the proposed plan in the U.S. and the Canadian or Australian models is that the Canadian Australian models are not as interested in restricting immigration flow, you know, and so that's really the key. It's not about the points-based system, which actually might be a positive. It's about just the overall cuts to the top line number, which I think is going to have the real impact for real estate investors.
And it feeds the narrative that you know, the current administration doesn't just want to restrict illegal immigration, they want to restrict immigration altogether. So that's really been a bone of contention for between the two political parties. But also, again, I think that they're getting a lot of pressure from business that really relies on immigration, sometimes seasonal immigration, certainly in the case of agriculture.
Indeed. I mean, this is definitely an issue that crosses party lines. You know, there are hardline immigration restrictionists who are Democrats, and there are pro-immigration Republicans. Like, this is not a party-based political issue, although perhaps it could be in the future as, you know, because Donald Trump has been so vocal in his position, it might cause some sort of realignment in the parties. But at the moment, it really, you know, your classic pro-business Chamber of Commerce Republican has had no interest in restricting legal immigration. They clearly see the economic benefits of population growth.
What else would you highlight in the September edition, Loretta? What else do you think that readers should be paying maybe some special attention to?
Well, we do a really in-depth look at what's happening in the retail industry, which I think, you know, that's very much been on the top of people's minds this summer with the ongoing bankruptcies that we're seeing in the retail industry. You know, the retail industry, that there are challenges confronting the regional malls around the country, and you know, I think that there could be some, there will be winners and losers from what we're looking at, which will be sort of a probably a pretty intense realignment within the retail industry going forward. Was it just this week that Toys R Us announced their bankruptcy? You know, it's almost like a week hasn't gone by this year without another high profile retailer announcing that they're going into bankruptcy. And you know, while some of that is being driven by the internet and the rise of e-commerce, the other thing that we're seeing is really that a lot of these retailers just took on a huge amount of debt about 10 years ago, and a lot of that is just, you know, the story's coming due at this point. I believe Toys R Us was taken private in 2005 by in a leveraged buyout with a number of private equity firms, as well as I believe Vornado Realty Trust was involved in that deal, and you know, they took on a huge amount of debt, took the company private, and they're now staggering under the weight of that debt. And a lot of these retailers are staggering under the weight of debt that was taken on just prior to the financial crisis. And many of these loans tend to come with a 10-year term. So
you just returned from the twice annual board meeting, and one of the points you made is that the most vigorous discussion, or one of the most vigorous discussions, was about retailing.
Right. The future of the retail industry is really, really top of mind for investors. And I think one of the messages coming out of that meeting was, you know, if you look at the broad mall industry, we might see one third of malls go completely under, just shut down and be repurposed into some other use, that there are better uses for those properties. But another third of malls are going to outperform significantly. Like retail is not dead. It's just really a matter of location, of property, of careful investment. You know, some malls are going to do really, really well. Some malls are going to do so bad they go out of business. And you just don't want to be owning, and this is also the point in the article that I'm talking about, you just do not want to own a Class B or C mall in a second tier location. You can't expect that investment to pay off over the long term. And you know, up to this point, and you know, in the past, these B malls were throwing off cash flow, and you know, it was a fine investment, and you know, many people have been very happy with it. But major tenants are going bankrupt. Many of them are closing stores and leaving these big empty anchors, and nothing's filling those spaces. And all of a sudden, you know, you lose one or two anchors and that is a dead mall, and now you've lost foot traffic and no one wants to go there. And you know, then the sort of the collective spiral decline kicks in, and wow, you know, that's the end of that property, which, you know, is okay. As a country, the United States is over-malled. We have way too much retail per square foot per person. Like, compared internationally, I think we have a chart in the story that highlights this, but you know, the number of square feet per people per person in this country is just shocking compared to other retail space around the world. For instance, right now in the US, there are 25 square feet of retail space per person in this country. You know, you want to compare that to somewhere like the UK, which is 5 square feet, or Germany, 2 square feet of retail space per capita. Like, you know, and maybe you could say, well, Germany could use a few more malls, and maybe they could, but we have too many malls. We just have too many malls. And so a lot of those properties are going to be turned into something else. And that's going to be a really interesting thing in the future. You might look at mixed-use lifestyle centers where you have a mix of retail and residential space. You might see some of them turned into light industrial, a warehouse right close to a freeway on-ramp where you can do same-day delivery and e-commerce fulfillment right in the middle of town. You know, there's so many things that you can do with that land. These are, you know, really prime parcels, big parcels. You could, you know, put in a whole housing development on a mall. So, you know, it's going to take capital. It's going to take a lot of capital, whether you are reinventing a mall into something else or whether you are investing in that mall to keep it, you know, to make it and keep it one of the you know, 30-35% that'll be outperforming. It's going to take a lot of capital. And so that's definitely something that's going to be an issue for investors going forward.
Well, I can give you a little personal experience on this. Within the last couple of months, I went back home to upstate New York, and there's a, in Johnson City, New York, there's the Oakdale Mall. It used to be a very thriving mall. It is, almost all the anchors are either gone or going. There's talk about it shutting down. I went into the business office there and asked who owns the mall. It turns out to be Vornado. I placed a call to Vornado, and not surprisingly, I didn't get a return call. I don't think they really want to talk about that situation with the Oakdale Mall. But one of the problems there is that that area is not a robust business environment, and repurposing that mall is not going to be a simple matter. That's one of the things I wanted to talk to them about, was whether they had some ideas, some plans, or whether they were looking to sell it. But what you were talking about, Loretta, the whole idea of America being over-retailed, that's been complained about for quite some time, and 25 square feet per person is every American's got their own little boutique kind of set aside for them. So it's a little bit much, and obviously I guess maybe finally it's thinning out to something a little bit more reasonable, e-commerce helping all that along as well. Anything else in the magazine you'd cite?
Well, I actually wanted to sort of bring our two discussions together. It's just a curiosity about upstate New York. Are you seeing population growth or population decline?
I can tell you that the main city there in the Triple Cities area, they call it, is Binghamton, New York. When I was growing up, Binghamton had 65,000 people. It has since declined to fewer than 50,000 people. So it's kind of a Rust Belt city. So there is population decline, but the other aspect of it's not just decline, but it's an aging population. So there are a lot of demographic forces at play here, and also just economic forces, the way things have changed, that we've become a much more technological society. And the irony of the whole thing is that Endicott, New York, which is part of that Triple Cities area, which is literally the town I grew up in, is where IBM was founded. And IBM used to employ thousands and thousands of people in the area. They are out of the area entirely. They don't. They have no presence at all anymore in Endicott or the Triple Cities area. So it's gonna be a rough go.
Right, and I just want to, so there I am just sort of linking the discussion about population growth and how important that is for economic growth, real estate investment growth. You know, when the mall goes under, you know, this is what happens when you don't have economic and population growth. Other stories in the issue that I might highlight, we've got a really interesting piece about Brazil, investing in Brazil right now, and how now might be the right time to start looking at Brazil, because things are bad there, but they are merely bad, not terrible. And that it is at the moment when things shift from just plain awful to only kind of bad that you can really find opportunity in a market.